Venezuela is roiling, and there's a new leader at the helm.
I mean, she has to almost, you know, have a double identity. She has to convince the Trump administration that she's playing ball, and she has to convince the military that she is also going to protect them.
I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Today, we profile Delcy Rodriguez and her rise to power, plus what losing Venezuelan oil means for Cuba.
We'll also hear about the crazy winter storms in Europe.
This kind of weather that we have experienced it's not normal snow.
Plus, one source of climate pollution we don't hear much about.
The footprint of a hospital, about 5% of that is coming just from inhaled anesthetics.
Yes, anesthesia, as in what's used in operating rooms.
All that and much more today here on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for being here today. It has been less than a week since the U.S. removed Venezuela's longtime leader, Nicolas Maduro, from power and arrested him in the middle of the night. That set in motion a rapid-fire series of events with reverberations across the globe.
We turn our attention today to the transfer of power to Maduro's Vice President, Delcy Rodriguez. On Monday, she was sworn in as the country's leader.
Vengo con dolor.
Rodriguez was solemn in tone as she pledged to guide Venezuela through these uncertain times.
Juro.
Her appointment was sudden, but she's long held a place of power in Venezuela with a purpose that is personal for her. The World's Tibisay Isaiah reports.
When Delcy Rodriguez was sworn in as Venezuela's de facto president earlier this week, journalist Ibeji Sepacheco was not surprised.
No he encontrado una pareja tan obsesionada con alcanzar el poder.
After years investigating Rodriguez and her brother Jorge, Pacheco published a book about how they built influence inside the Venezuelan government. She says they were obsessed with reaching power, governing a country, doing business, and enriching themselves. It's a harsh assessment, but it reflects a view shared by many in Venezuela, that the Rodriguez siblings rose as operators working in the background. Leonardo Vivas, a Venezuelan politics researcher, says for Delcy Rodriguez, politics has always been something very personal.
Delcy Rodriguez is the daughter of a Venezuelan guerrilla fighter who was killed in the 70s during an interrogation where he was tortured.
His daughter, Delcy, was only 7 years old.
The perpetrators of the crime were prosecuted, convicted, and they had to pay. They went to jail.
But he says the experience left a painful mark. Rodriguez later acknowledged that, quote, the Chavista revolution is our revenge for the death of our father.
Su mayor fortaleza es que entre ellos son simbióticos. Los une la fuerza del resentimiento.
Pacheco says the siblings grew closer and learned to distrust the military and the institutions of the old Venezuelan state. Delcy Rodriguez is a lawyer educated in France. Her resume combines elite education with deep roots inside the revolutionary movement. But her real rise to political prominence came after the death of Hugo Chavez. She was a key player in the Maduro regime, inside ministries and negotiating rooms. Viva says she and her brother Jorge were some of the most effective operators for Nicolás Maduro.
She played a number of roles, intermediate roles. Then she was Minister of Foreign Affairs. And recently she was not only vice president of the country, but also a president of PDVSA.
PDVSA is Venezuela's state oil company, the core of the country's economy. Those posts put her in charge of oil and state finances in the depths of Venezuela's collapse. When the country was facing hyperinflation, empty shelves, and mass migration, it was Rodriguez who took charge. Oscar Zambrano, an economist in Caracas, explains she loosened price controls, she allowed the dollar to circulate, and opened the door to imports.
And that allowed to stop the 8-year-long collapse of the economy and produce some growth. Not a spectacular growth, but at least the economy started to show some signs of dynamism.
Her policies were enough to win over business leaders. But Rodriguez has also had her share of corruption scandals. Investigative journalist Roberto Deniz is now exiled in Colombia.
Ella ha logrado hacerse de una red de operadores financieros, intermediarios.
He says that under Rodriguez, a network of oil traders, financial intermediaries, and favored businessmen flourished. People who profited by moving sanctioned Venezuelan oil through opaque channels. Rodriguez has been sanctioned by the U.S., Canada, the UK, and the European Union. All four have accused her of undermining democratic institutions and benefiting from corruption. Now she's navigating her most difficult role yet.
She's, I guess, the president. She was sworn as president just a little while ago when she said, "We'll do whatever you need." I think she was quite gracious, but she really doesn't have a choice.
She's an outspoken critic of imperialism, who now needs a U.S. president's support to stay in power. Even so, Will Freeman, a political scientist, says her real challenge is internal.
I mean, she has to almost, you know, have a double identity. She has to convince the Trump administration that she's playing ball, and she has to convince the military that she is also going to protect them. And I just don't know how far she can take that.
For a leader shaped by personal distrust of the armed forces, that balancing act may define whether her presidency lasts or collapses. For The World, I'm Tibisa Isea.
Our coverage of news from Venezuela continues later in the show with a deep dive into how people are feeling the impact in Cuba, a close ally of the country. That's coming up later this hour.
Now, here is a fact I find very surprising. A common anesthesia drug is also a climate super pollutant. It is called desflurane, and when it comes to its impact on warming the planet, the gas is several thousand times more potent than carbon dioxide. Starting January 1st, the European Union banned its use, except when this specific drug is medically necessary. That is the focus today of our Big Fix segment, where we talk about the most ambitious attempts to tackle climate change. Jody Sherman is an anesthesiologist and directs Yale's program on healthcare environmental sustainability. She says one of the issues with all inhaled anesthetics is how medical facilities dispose of them.
After they are used, they are vented off of the rooftop of the facilities and just let out to the outdoor environment. And then they live in the atmosphere, depending on the drug, anywhere from 1 to 10 years in the case of the class of drugs like desflurane. But importantly is not just how potent the drug is in terms of its heat trapping capacity, but also how potent it is when we deliver it to a patient. Mm. So desflurane has much lower potency than the other drugs, so you have to use more of it in addition to it being a higher
greenhouse
gas trapping drug.
So these are drugs that patients inhale when they're in surgery or something like that. And so when or why are they vented? Is that just that most of them actually go unused and have to be kind of disposed of into the air?
No, that's a great question. So our body doesn't really metabolize them, maybe a tiny bit in the case of sevoflurane, but essentially, as you're breathing them, they do what we intend them to do, and they make you unaware and not feel pain while you're and induce sleep. But when you're done breathing them, they just get vented off the rooftop.
So we breathe them in and they do their job, and then we basically just breathe them back out.
That's correct. And okay. We need to protect indoor staff so that they don't fall asleep during surgery. So they have to,
that is very important.
Right. So they're sucked out and vented off of the facility. Now there is some technology that exists to try and capture those gases for potential reuse or at least for storage. But their efficiency rates are really quite low. So they're not really a viable solution.
Hmm. So how commonly used right now is desflurane, and why would you use it as opposed to any of the other alternatives that might be available?
Well, there are three common volatile anesthetics. That's the class of drug that desflurane is in common use. In some parts of the world, there's a fourth medication that's fallen out of favor because it's toxic to liver, and that's halothane, but it is still common in use in low resource settings, and that's being phased out. And so they all functionally do the same thing, but they have slightly different properties, including how fast you fall asleep and wake up and how potent they are. So how much drug you need to, or how much volume or mass of the medication you need to have the same clinical effect.
So how hard is it for anesthesiologists, especially those, for example, in Europe, where desflurane is largely banned, how hard is it to replace it with a different drug of its class?
Oh, it's super easy. We have other medications we give all the time. Through intravenous routes, we give phenylephrine, ephedrine, epinephrine, drugs you've probably heard of before. So there is nothing about desflurane clinically that makes it so unique that we need to keep it.
So this feels like a little bit of low-hanging fruit if we're thinking about the climate impact of, for example, hospitals. Is that fair?
It's a very low-hanging fruit, and for multiple reasons, including that the drug is much more expensive than the other drugs. So we substituted sevoflurane for desflurane at the Yale New Haven Health System back in 2013 and estimated that simple substitution saved our organization $1.2 million just in drug procurement costs and,
wow.
and you know, alone. But it's also important to know that all the inhaled anesthetics are greenhouse gases, but desflurane is definitely a low-hanging fruit.
Mm. Do you know what are the sort of projected environmental greenhouse gas savings with, you know, all of Europe banning desflurane except in medically necessary cases?
Unfortunately, I don't know. It depends on what they've already been purchasing or purchasing in the most recent years, because everything you buy just, you know, gets used and just tossed in the environment.
Yeah.
So we need to know how much is being procured. I can tell you desflurane has been falling out of favor for well over a decade now. There's just been a lot of traction and interest in healthcare overall, and particularly in our specialty, around the concerns of environmental contamination coming from the healthcare industry and what can be done about it. There has been action throughout the U.S. and also Europe in particular, and now across Canada and other parts of the world and Asia. It's really caught on globally that the popularity of the medication has really declined because of this concern.
Mm. Yeah, I did want to talk about the bigger picture of the healthcare industry trying to reduce its climate impact. I was reading that the emissions from just desflurane have a climate impact equivalent to the greenhouse gas emissions from approximately 1.5 million automobiles. So that is not nothing. It is also not a huge portion of the world's greenhouse gases. So let's talk bigger picture a little bit. What else is the healthcare industry doing to try to reduce its carbon footprint or greenhouse gas footprint?
Well, let's take a step back. That number might sound trivial, but if you start delving down to the healthcare system, it's actually a bigger number. So there is data to suggest that the footprint of a hospital, about 5% of that is coming just from inhaled anesthetics.
Hmm.
Now, if you take a step further into perioperative services, surgical services, about half the footprint in the operating room is coming just from inhaled anesthetics.
Wow.
So if you could knock that down, there's a huge opportunity there.
And across the healthcare system, you know, not just in the operating room or for anesthesia, how big of a priority is it to cut greenhouse gas emissions? Is this something your field is really starting to try to tackle?
Well, there is a lot of global interest in this space right now. A lot of this is being driven by health professionals and health professional concerns, because we understand really quite, not only professionally, but it really is quite personal, that we are causing harm when we take care of patients, which is against our mission. So this, the movement is really coming from the ground up through the health professionals. Where we really need help is in strengthening regulations, because there's only so much agency you have as a health professional. You really need to change our organizations to try and drive more sustainable actions. So it really requires a whole government approach. We need regulations to drive accountability.
Jody Sherman directs Yale's program on healthcare environmental sustainability. You're listening to The World.
Right.
Right now, we are living through some of the most tumultuous political times our country has ever known. I'm David Remnick, and each week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, I'll try to make sense of what's happening alongside politicians and thinkers like Cory Booker, Nancy Pelosi, Liz Cheney, Tim Walz, Ketanji Brown Jackson, Newt Gingrich, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., Charlemagne the God, and so many more. That's all in the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. In Paris, the hilly hipster neighborhood of Montmartre transformed into a winter wonderland this week. Woo! Social media videos show residents skiing down historic stone steps there. France, the UK, and other parts of Western Europe are getting hit with intense winter weather. As our transportation correspondent Jeremy Siegel reports, it is unfortunately not all fun and games.
In northeastern Scotland, traffic is frozen, literally. The Aberdeenshire Council posted a video on X that shows a massive plow trying to clear piles of snow from the road, but after just a few seconds, the truck gets stuck. Western Europe has been pummeled by freezing temperatures and heavy snow over the past several days, forcing authorities from central France up to northern Scotland to close down schools, railways, and roads. In Paris, bus service has come to a complete stop. France's transport minister Philippe Tamaro told a French talk show the accumulation has simply been too much for mass transit to operate safely. Some of the region's busiest airports have also canceled thousands of flights, leaving passengers stranded.
This kind of weather that we have experienced it's not normal snow.
Daniel Gustafsson is a former Stockholm-based pilot who writes about air traffic disruptions for the website Flight Radar 24.
Some airports have been struck worse than others, with Amsterdam Schiphol being by far the most affected one.
Gustafsson says Amsterdam isn't used to seeing super heavy snow, and the city's airport didn't have enough de-icing fluid on hand to get planes off the ground.
So as the weather got worse, they used the fluids, and they depleted their supplies faster than they could replenish them. Simple as that.
The end result, more than 3,000 flights unable to take off, with more than 1,000 passengers forced to spend the night at the airport. And the next 24 hours are not expected to bring any sort of reprieve.
Storm Goretti is moving into the southwest of the UK as we speak. Storms are named when they're set to cause widespread disruption, and this definitely will.
Goretti got its name from France's meteorological agency. The storm is making its way across the UK towards northwestern France, Belgium, and the Netherlands. AccuWeather's chief international forecaster Jason Nichols tells me that this weather system started small in the Atlantic, but over the past couple days, it's developed into what's commonly referred to as a bomb cyclone.
It's a rapidly intensifying storm. The southwest peninsula of England is definitely going to have wind gusts past hurricane force.
UK authorities have issued do not travel warnings on several major roadways and closed down multiple busy train lines until Saturday morning. Nichols says London will see a slippery combination of snow and rain. And in France, where 5 people have already died in road crashes during the snowy weather, the addition of rain could lead to flooding. For The World, I'm Jeremy Siegel.
Staying in Europe, here's something Europeans are hearing more often, at least when they're not snowed in. Sound effects electric vehicles made by the Chinese manufacturer BYD emit to alert pedestrians that they're around. BYD, which is short for Build Your Dreams, sold around 2.3 million EVs last year, topping for the first time American rival Tesla. BYD's market share is growing super fast in Europe. The World's Jerry Haddon reports from Barcelona.
BYD has 3 big dealerships in Barcelona alone. I pop into one to ask what's made its cars so popular. But sales reps aren't authorized to talk. They refer me to Luisa from marketing, who never gets back to me. Maybe when you reach number one, you don't really feel a need to talk about it.
El SIL, que es el modelo SUV. Me gusta estéticamente, es el coche más europeo que veo de todos los chinos que he visto.
But just outside, I meet a potential buyer, a guy named Tony Fabregas from Barcelona. I'm looking at the BYD SEAL, he tells me, the SUV. Of all the Chinese vehicles I've looked at, it's the most European looking, a bit like the Porsche Cayenne, he says. Fabregas hasn't pulled the trigger yet. He says he's still mulling over the price, around $45,000. That's a little bit more than a Tesla, but Fabregas says he's not interested.
No. No he mirado Tesla.
I haven't even looked at the Teslas, he tells me. I don't even know if they offer a high-sitting SUV. They don't, at least not in Europe. Tesla offers only two models here, both sedans, the Y and the 3. That limited selection is one reason why BYD is gobbling up market share across the continent, says Murtuza Ali, a senior research analyst at Counterpoint Research in Hong Kong.
BYD has a vast EV model portfolio, which spans multiple segments and price points. Entry-level models, which are very competitively priced, and they provide a good amount of feature for the value-conscious buyers.
BYD's entry-level EV, the Surf, goes for as little as $14,000 and has up to 200 miles of autonomy. Plus, says Ali, the interiors are nicer than Tesla's, with more modern infotainment, as he calls it. The company, with billions of dollars in government support, is now investing heavily in overseas markets.
There is thinning of margins in China, and it's a very cutthroat competition with over 100 brands competing in electric vehicles in China market. So export has become their significant focus to improve their profitability and, you know, utilize their capacity.
Overseas sales are key for Tesla too, but there's another component to the company that seems to be hurting the bottom line. Its founder, the South African-born Elon Musk.
This is the chainsaw for bureaucracy. Chainsaw!
That was Musk last year, dressed in black and wielding a chainsaw, as the head of President Donald Trump's federal budget slashing program known as DOGE. Early research suggests these sorts of antics and the politics behind them are costing Musk's car company big bucks. Frank Du Bois is a retired professor from the Kogod School of Business at American University.
There's a paper that's been published recently, a National Bureau of Economic Research working paper. The research has estimated that the Musk effect potentially cost Tesla 1 to 1.2 million sales.
That's in the U.S. alone.
In fact, you will often see Tesla, older Tesla cars with decals in the window that say, I bought this car before Elon went crazy. So that's having an effect. They haven't done research on this in the European Union, but you can be sure that given his activities in Europe in terms of trying to manipulate elections and things like that, that's going to have an effect.
It's good to be proud of German culture, German values.
Here's Musk in 2025 addressing an election rally for Germany's far-right anti-immigrant AfD party, where he was hailed as a hero.
And not to lose that in some sort of multiculturalism that dilutes everything.
As Du Bois says, no analysis has been done on the so-called Musk effect on European sales, but they were down nearly everywhere in Europe last year. 48% in Germany, 67% in Sweden. Two dealerships in France were set ablaze. Another was attacked in Italy. As Teslas burned, Chinese-made BYDs rolled into European showrooms. For The World, I'm Jerry Hatton, Barcelona.
You're with The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. At the White House tomorrow, U.S. oil executives will meet with President Trump to discuss plans for how and when their companies will go to Venezuela to drill. This picks up on something he said last weekend, just minutes into his announcement about the removal of President Nicolas Maduro.
We're going to have our very large United States oil companies, the biggest anywhere in the world, go in, spend billions of dollars, fix the badly broken infrastructure, the oil infrastructure, and start making money for the country.
One knock-on effect of that plan will be felt in Cuba, a country that has been dependent on Venezuelan oil and is now cut off.
The island's economy had already been taking a beating. Now gas stations across Cuba are shuttering because there's nothing to sell. And where there is fuel, there are long lines for it. We're going to hear from two people on what's going on in a moment, a Cuban-American oil expert. But first, we go to Ed Augustin, a journalist based in Havana.
Here, every single day, for about 4 hours a day, every person's power cuts out. But it gets worse in most of the country, in the provinces, where 5/6 of the Cuban population lives. There, every single day, for most of the day, I repeat, most of the day, for 12, 15, 18, 20 hours, people are living without power.
Just how disruptive is that in the city or in the country where it's much longer, these blackouts?
It means that there's more disease because Cuba used to be very good at keeping tropical diseases at bay, but they're not anymore because they don't have enough fuel to fumigate. So right now there's an epidemic in the country of chikungunya, which is a nasty mosquito-borne disease, and also dengue. A third of the population has had that so far, according to the Ministry of Health here. That's a debilitating disease. Cubans are in pain. Many have died. Food rots if you can't keep the fridge on. Doctors have either migrated to the US or are working, many of them flipping burgers, waiting tables in the private sector. And that means that the health service, which in Cuba used to, which used to be very, very good by global South standards, let's say, is cratering. So every single socioeconomic indicator over the last 6 years has got far, far worse. And people are now bracing for even more pain.
Do most Cubans see a link between the news from Venezuela and these day-to-day struggles they're facing? And is there a sense that the situation will inevitably get worse because of the country's reliance on Venezuelan oil?
Yes and yes. The Cuban government is unpopular at the moment. But I was surprised, I was taken back at the indignation of the Cuban people I've spoken to, not just at the government rallies that I've covered, but also speaking to regular people on the street. There was widespread indignation and anger that the United States had abducted, as many people put it to me, the head of state of their main ally. And even though the government is unpopular, and how could it not be, given just to take one thing, the fact that they've presided over 5 years of immiseration of the Cuban population, people were clear. This event in Venezuela and the new government and the U.S. coercion of that new government to, according to Donald Trump, stop oil deliveries to Cuba. We'll see whether that actually plays out. Will directly make living standards worse. So people were very, very clear that their lot is going to get even harder.
What has been the official Cuban government response to events in Venezuela?
President Miguel Díaz-Canel spoke at a rally outside the U.S. embassy hours after the abduction took place on Saturday morning. He addressed about 20,000 people, mainly party faithful, who tend to be drawn from older sectors of the population in Cuba these days. And he was visibly furious. He's not a very charismatic politician, but you could see the emotion. He was irate. So they described this as a criminal act. They described it as a breach of international law. And he also characterized it as state terrorism. And also adding to the mix, the Cubans were providing security. The Cuban state has always been very, very good at intelligence and security. And after the United States backed a coup in 2002 to overthrow the then democratically elected Venezuelan president, Hugo Chavez, the Venezuelans and the Cubans struck a deal. The Venezuelans would ship very, very cheap oil to Cuba, and Cuba would pay for it in kind. How would they pay for it? With around about 20,000 doctors, thousands of teachers, but also, it was hush-hush, less spoken about, although everyone knew of it, intelligence agents and security personnel. 32 of those people died, according to the Cuban government, on Saturday. I've seen the photos. They're very grisly. And it was a rare point on Saturday where the Cuban population that increasingly doesn't support the government and the government were on the same page. Outrage that these people have been killed. Outrage that the head of state of their main ally has been abducted.
I was going to ask you about those 32 Cubans who were killed in the seizure of Nicolas Maduro last weekend. Those 32 Cubans who were killed, how are they being remembered in Havana?
There's been 2 days of mourning that started on Monday. So flags flying at half mast. The Cuban government is very intransparent, but they have been more transparent about this than most. This is an uncomfortable truth for them to admit publicly because Secretary of State Marco Rubio has been pointing to Cuban, what he calls colonization, of Venezuela as part of the casus belli, as part of the legitimation of what the United States are doing in Venezuela and Cuba. So it was rather surprising that the Cuban government came out with it, admitted it, that they didn't kind of skim over it. But in the official newspaper, you had a double-page spread. The title, I think, was Honor and Glory. And you had the 32 people. All of them were either from the Cuban Armed Forces or the Cuban Ministry of the Interior. They're being cast as martyrs here. And so I could describe Cuban political dynamics like this at the moment. The government, the Cuban government, or the Cuban regime, if you prefer, has never been less popular. The internal opposition to it has never been weaker, because you have many in jail and even more in exile. And US policy towards Cuba is also deeply unpopular, because people accurately see that US policy towards Cuba aims at and succeeds at immiserating them. So it's a very funny dynamic.
Is the defiance we saw in Cuba in recent years also gone? Is that one of the impacts of the economic misery?
I think it's fair to say there's less defiance overall than there was. You know, I wasn't alive in the 1960s, but from reading history books and speaking to people that were alive, there was a real fervor and defiance that characterized the Cuban political experience. This political project stands out because it's like a boxer that you can't quite knock out. You know, it's kind of lost its verve, but as long as you hit it, you just can't knock it out. There's a popular saying here, no hay quien lo tumbe, ni quien lo arregle. Nobody can knock it down, but nobody can fix it either. And so there has been despondency and hopelessness. What struck me, though, is that as of Saturday, I saw a real rage amongst the population. I wasn't expecting it. You know, you go to the official events where the party faithful are there, and they basically parrot. Their language is very similar to Cuban presidents, because some of them are told and pressured to be there. Others want to be there, and they're, you know, the hardcore believers. But when I was walking on the street speaking to most people, and I spoke to over a dozen people, there was real indignation about the US capture of Maduro. So I think some of that indignation's coming back. It's too early to tell, but perhaps under unprecedented external pressure, perhaps there'll be a rally around the flag effect.
Ed Augustin is an independent journalist based in Cuba. He joined us from Havana with a view from the ground there. That still leaves questions, though, about the commodity causing so much anxiety in Cuba, oil. Jorge Piñon studies Cuba's energy infrastructure at the University of Texas, Austin. He told me today that Cuba has stockpiled some fuel, but the reserves will not last long.
We have run an estimate that they can probably have storage for anywhere between 30 to 40 days. And that 30 to 40 days is actually by shutting down also a lot of inefficient factories and government offices and so on, just enough supply of oil for basic services. We believe that 30 to 45 days is going to be the max that they will have.
I know some Cubans are hoping that other countries will be able to come to their rescue. We know Mexico supplies a modest but still important supply of oil to Cuba, some tens of thousands of barrels daily. When we spoke with you, Jorge, a few weeks ago, one big open question was whether Mexico would yield to U.S. pressure and cut that oil off. Is there any new clarity on that front?
Tomorrow morning, a small tanker, 85,000 barrels, will arrive in Havana from the Pemex terminal of Pajaritos. And we have seen that small tanker now for the last month or so going back and forth between Mexico and Cuba. We have not seen any other large tanker supplying Cuba with Mexican oil. Yesterday, we did an inventory, and there's only four countries in the world that besides Russia, Venezuela, and Mexico could come to Cuba and get them out of this bind. That will be Angola and Algeria in Africa. They're both politically aligned with Cuba, and they're both net exporters of oil. And the other two are Colombia and Brazil, that are net exporters of oil. And again, they are, quote unquote, politically aligned with Cuba. But we have not seen those four countries coming to Cuba's rescue.
Pemex, of course, is the big Mexican state-owned oil concern. What about countries like Russia and China? I mean, do you expect them to step in and fill the vacuum?
China doesn't have any oil to export. China is a net importer. So the only thing that China could provide would be credit lines for Cuba to buy oil in the international market. And we haven't seen that. Russia has been our great surprise. We expected Russia, with all of the tankers that they have floating that are sanctioned and looking for a home, we thought that Cuba would be a perfect outlet for them. But we have only seen them supply Cuba with a tanker every quarter or so. In fact, just recently, about 2 weeks ago, a small Russian tanker sanctioned by the European Union left Cuba, and it dropped about 350,000 barrels. So again, yes, the Russians are there, but they're not there with the volume and capacity of fuel line or crude that we expected.
I'm curious why these friends of Cuba, like Angola, Algeria, Colombia, and Brazil, why they have not stepped up with oil supplies and whether you think they could still step up.
There's no benefit. In the old days when Fidel was around, there was a political benefit that gave those countries an advantage. Not today. The Cuban Revolution today is not what the Cuban Revolution was 10, 15 years ago. So you don't get any brownie points politically for those countries by helping Cuba today. They'll talk about it and they'll continue to support Cuba and its revolution, but not with hard oil. By the way, and also because they don't want to get in trouble with the Washington administration of Donald Trump.
So Jorge, along with the U.S. economic blockade, how long can Cubans keep the lights on?
Right now, this morning, by the way, UNE, which is the monopoly, the electric power monopoly, announced that they expected 1,600 megawatts of deficit. That's about 40% of Cuba's capacity. So that means that today and tonight, 40% of the country will be without electricity. And that's being about every single night, the reports show the same deficit. They have built some solar power plants, about 10 or 15 of them with Chinese help, by the way. But there are small power plants of 21 megawatts each. They don't have any big utility batteries, so they're power plants that only operate during the day when the sun is out.
There is also a group of oil tankers operating outside of international oversight, the so-called shadow fleet. That's how sanctioned countries like Russia, Iran, and Venezuela were moving oil. To what extent did Cuba rely on the shadow fleet, and what's happening now?
That's not there anymore. These phantom tankers that were arriving in Cuba are not going to be there. The next 6 to 8 weeks are going to be key. We're going to be looking forward to see if the Trump administration reaches an agreement with Caracas and asks Venezuela to continue to supply Cuba with oil. I don't think that the U.S. could handle another second can of worms. They created one in Venezuela. They have their hands full with Venezuela. Do they really want another situation of a failed state or a collapsing state just 90 miles away from U.S. shores? If I was the U.S., I think they would be talking to Caracas and saying at least continue to supply oil to Cuba until further notice so that they can focus on how to take care of the Venezuelan problem and then tackle Cuba later on down the road.
Yeah, let me just ask you a sidebar question on that. What could Donald Trump's meeting with oil executives tomorrow do in that direction, do you think?
I wish I could be there. I think for the first time, the oil executives are going to bring the administration down to reality and the real world. There's no oil company in the world that is going to spend billions of dollars in a country without any contractor and commercial commitment, without any type of guarantee of political guarantee of continuity. I just don't see an Exxon or a Chevron spending billions of dollars in the next 2 to 3 years in Venezuela for then all of a sudden to be a different administration in Washington or in Caracas and say, oh, by the way, sorry, the rules of the game have changed. The oil companies are not going to take that risk.
So you're a Cuban exile and a former Shell and Amoco executive. You used to make yearly visits to Cuba. Do you get the sense that the country's energy ministry has a contingency plan?
I can guarantee you that they know the situation that they're in, and they know that they don't have an answer. The other thing is that there is no Fidel. Back in the special period, you had Fidel, and there was Fidelismo. And every Cuban in the street would say, well, Fidel will take care of this.
Being that period where Russia kind of backed out of the relationship and they were left on their own.
In the early 90s, correct. Cuba doesn't have that persona anymore. The future transition of Cuba doesn't have that persona anymore. Who's going to run Cuba tomorrow? The opposition is non-existent. The church is not there. So the only hope that Cuba has are the military, and not the top military, but the middle-level military, that maybe they'll play a role. But that is the other challenge that Cuba faces. Who is going to lead that country into a very, very dangerous road of a transition period that, to me, it's about to take place?
I'm wondering if you see perhaps pragmatists within the Cuban government who see a way out of this whole predicament by actually cutting a deal with the Trump administration.
Yeah, I think that's certainly, yes. But again, you said it, with the Trump administration, what happens in the next 3 to 5 years? Who are they going to negotiate with? And what kind of guarantees are they going to have? Either side, by the way, that whatever the agreement is going to be able to be executed and be implemented, and there will be commitment to that agreement.
Jorge Piñon there, speaking with me from the University of Texas in Austin. We've been reporting today on both Cuba and Venezuela here at The World. Find all those stories at theworld.org.
We have a blast from the past in England to tell you about now. Archaeologists there have discovered a bronze war trumpet from the Iron Age.
The Celtic war horn, called a carnax, is still largely intact. It was used to put fear into the hearts of the enemy and to rally troops during battle. The one we just heard is a replica, played here in a video from the National Museum Scotland.
Experts say the horn is an extremely rare find. It's thought to be the most complete example of this kind of trumpet discovered anywhere on Earth. The carnax has a trumpet-like mouthpiece attached to a long metal tube. The end of that tube is shaped like an animal head, so it looks like the sound is coming out of its mouth. Archaeologists are still studying the horn to determine which Celtic tribe might have made it. Other military objects found at the same site include parts of shields and a bronze battle standard. That's basically a metal flag in the shape of a boar's head.
You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Migration is a hot-button issue across the globe. Politicians in many places have turned restricting immigration into a cudgel. And yet people moving around has been part of the human condition since the beginning of time. Paul Salopek has a unique perspective on humans crossing borders. He's a National Geographic explorer traveling from Ethiopia to Chile on foot. I asked him whether he's noticed significant changes as he goes.
I am moving at boot level through these big streams of humanity. I'm one little particle, a very privileged one, moving among masses of human beings that are often moving for very tragic reasons, right? They're either going to a place where they hope life is going to be better, drawn by economic promise, stability, or fleeing violence or climate crises back home. And it's from day one, Marco, migration has been a huge part of my journey. My journey is based on ancient migrations. And I think now there just seems to be kind of more of an awareness of it. Back when I started in 2013, people focused on it piecemeal, like, you know, African migrants going into Europe or you know, Latin American migrants going into North America. But now I think it's becoming a little bit more globally kind of an issue in the zeitgeist. And you know, the question that I'm asking myself, are walls going up because of it?
So, Paul, you've walked through about 24 countries at this point. That's a lot of stamps in your passport. How has crossing borders, like the actual passage from one country to another, how has that changed in recent years?
I just get a sense, kind of a gut sense, Marco, that just crossing borders has become a little bit more fraught, right? When I started out, there were some big wars along my route, Assyria. And of course, those borders were dicey. But it just seemed less, you know, less of an issue to kind of go over land borders. And now I think there just seems to be a bit more scrutiny. And I'm not sure why. I have certain theories, but I don't have any way to prove them.
I wonder if there was perhaps one moment that you can recall on your trek at one port of entry, and you were in contact with a wide range of people with a wide range of reasons for migrating, and what that was like.
Yeah, I mean there have been a bunch landing in Turkey from a cargo ship. The ferry boats and the cargo boats are just offloading tons of people from the Middle East, and then a little bit further along, people are literally breaking down border fences. There was the war was on in Syria, and an entire city called Kobani was stampeding over the border into Turkey, and it was astonishing to see. So this notion of borders hardening and softening, I think they're very fluid. You know, I've made the metaphor before of them being like glaciers, right? That thousands of years ago, when the first hunters, you know, roamed the planet, glaciers stopped them, and then they stopped until they melted. I've had to do that on this journey as well. I waited 9 months in the country of Georgia to get an Iranian visa, and I never got one.
Hospitality has always been a central part of your journey. We've spoken about that a lot. You often place a lot of trust in the kindness of strangers you meet. But I wonder what the rise of anti-immigrant sentiments in many parts of the world has done to shrink the kindness factor, or maybe even increasing suspicion and mistrust.
I'm wondering that too. So far, nobody has like overtly kind of mistreated me or kind of shunned me any more than kind of as usual over the years. But I think what I'm seeing is under my feet, there's this tectonic shift happening in the world where my identity, not just as a white guy, but even my political identity as American, is different than it was more than a decade ago, right? Maybe more than a decade ago, my passport carried more weight and more privilege, earned or unearned, right? And now I think we're kind of moving into a multipolar world situation where I might just be one nationality among many. So I think I'm feeling that more than kind of a, you know, like a shutting the door in my face. It's more like, oh, you're American, so what, right? I think we're entering a new time, a new polity in geopolitics right now.
Going back to the first Trump administration and his intense focus on a border wall, building it longer and higher, you encountered the Great Wall of China on your trek, and it was after walking along it when walls really began to take on a different meaning for you. Explain that.
Yeah, you know, it's true, because something that has struck me, certain things, very different cultures, thousands of kilometers and miles apart, repeat over and over again, and one is walls. I mean, some of the earliest structures that I came across in the Holy Land were walls built back in ancient times, and even the new wall, the separating wall in Jerusalem, which you probably know, you've probably seen. And then beyond that, the next kind of iconic set of walls are walled cities on the Silk Road, and then beyond that, the Great Wall of China, right? And so I remember standing on a really amazing stretch of the Great Wall of China, one that wasn't developed for tourism, it was kind of eroding into the mountainsides, but still quite impressive, with a Chinese archaeologist, and we're talking about walls. What do walls do to societies? Do they defend them or do they isolate them? And at what point does that change, right? And so, yeah, I think walls are a complicating factor. The fact that the United States, the richest economy in the history of humankind, is building a wall is a pretty sobering thing. You know, I understand the impulse, but it also suggests, you know, maybe policy failures, right? Anytime a wall goes up.
I mean, Paul, the Out of Eden walk has connected you to the ancient world when people were much more nomadic than today, a time when borders were not marked with signs and crossing them did not require officialdom or passports or stamps. Can you speak to some of the pros and cons of that old way of living? And are there lessons to be learned from that history in today?
Yeah, I mean, as somebody who makes his living by being a nomad, I see huge advantages to kind of getting to know people who are different than you. I also, however, respect the kind of friction and the kind of ripples they send through settled communities. To have strangers come in, you know, can be a bit jarring if you don't know who they are. They look different. They speak different languages. I get that. But I think it's helpful for me if my readers come to me and say, Paul, what lesson do you bring to us from walking across the world, looking at deep history? I would say, you know, keep a nomadic mindset. Somewhere within your toolkit of what you do to how you survive in the world, being footloose can be an advantage, because from day one, when we were running away from major droughts in Africa back in the unwritten era of the Stone Age, to wars in more historic times, to, you know, whatever, just geopolitical change, movement is one of the kind of go-to survival mechanisms of Homo sapiens. And if you don't move, you're at a disadvantage. So keep kind of a psychic bag packed. Don't always look at it as an emergency thing or a negative thing. It can have huge positive connotations as well. That's the lesson I've taken away from this project.
That's National Geographic explorer Paul Salopek on his Out of Eden walk. Paul, as always, thanks very much and safe travels.
Thank you, Marco. It's always great to be on.
Online, we've got Paul's dispatches and some amazing photos from the Out of Eden walk. Go to outofedenwalk.nationalgeographic.org.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston.
And from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org and find our original reporting on YouTube. That's also where you can subscribe to our channel. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for being here and come back again tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org. And by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more, fjc.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. More information at theworld.org.